Okay, thank you. Okay, well, I will first like to thank Fabrice and also Laurent Buret that I didn't know, and Les Publications de la Sorbonne for, and of course Malcolm, without him nothing was possible, for giving us the opportunity to read Chartism in French. And to discuss it with him today. It was not easy. I mean, I saw Fabrice from the beginning, and it was a big challenge to do that. I mean, it took a great deal of time, it took a great deal of energy, of work, but they made it. And I think we can be happy. And for me, it's indeed for me a real privilege to get this book translated into French. And I hope it will be for you too. And I hope, above all, it will help giving more impulsion and dynamics to the 19th century British social history in this country. So, no doubt the book is demanding, not for its writing, nor for its organization, which are both, I will come back on this part, but which are both, in my view, simple, pleasant, and compelling. But because it requires to be fully understood and appreciated, it requires being aware of the early 19th century social and economical context of the UK, of its political system, of the way institutions like the police, the judiciary, or the workhouses work at that time, which is not simple at that time. In other terms, the book doesn't appear to me to be self-sufficient for a reader who is ignorant of the 19th century UK context and realities. And it could be a problem. But on the other hand, I read it, even if the book is an important book, I read it almost without stopping, and I finished it with the very odd sensation and feeling to have a kind of family link with a kind of intimacy with these men and women of the early 19th century, with the Chartists. One of the strongest effects of this book, among many others, but one of the strongest in my view, is to provide such a comprehensive atmosphere, such a comprehensive mood with the social actors of the history. And this is really, to my mind, one of the main virtues, if not the main, of the discipline of history. I think it's useless to add more compliments. We can do it later. But, and I would like to enter a bit more the discussion with, I will be, it will be a short presentation, to three different questions of different and of unequal interest. The first one regards the cultural moment that Chartism points out and embodies. These 20 years finally appeared to me, when I finished your book, appears to me as an obvious moment of cultural transition. At the beginning of the movement, and at the beginning of your book, you insist rightly on the oral tradition of the movement. What do we see? Outdoors meeting on the green, gathering of people in pubs and churches, the vital importance given to rhetoric, to the art of speaking. I fully appreciate the moment when the Chartists are in London in the House of Commons, and when they see the MPs, these men don't know how to speak, and even Disraeli. I mean, it was what a poor performance the MP gave to these people who were themselves champions of the art of speaking, champion of rhetoric. That is wonderful. So speeches, but also songs, poetry, and many other rituals clearly fall within the frame of an oral culture. Okay, it's very clear, appears very clearly at the beginning. But the movement progressively gets through a print culture, and above all through newspapers, and you show the importance of progressively taken by the main newspaper, I mean the Northern Star, which is really a major actor of the play and of your book. So the idea, and I really like to know if you agree with that idea, was that moment was really a moment of crucial, unequal, but crucial transition to print culture, which also, and I go back to the last point of your presentation, which also could explain why Chartism could not be reduced or limited to a printed text or a printed culture. My second question regards the place of the people charter in Chartism. Finally, maybe I'm wrong, but I really read it like that. Finally, your book leaves little room to the famous 6 points of the Charter and insists on the contrary on many other components of the movement: the concern for education, for religion, for sobriety and temperance, the necessity of strikes, the preparation of election, above all in the second part of the movement, and even what I did not know until then, because I'm not a specialist of that moment, the agrarian plan. I discovered this from a couple episodes of Connorville, which I completely ignore. So you point out a much more complex political and social environment in which the people charters finally appears as a kind of background or even as a secondary point. In a way, I had the impression in reading your book that the fact and principle of gathering people, of gathering the people, prevails over the exact content of the Charter. That was what Lovett, I mean, it's a quotation that you give in a moment in the book, that what Lovett and Colin called once, and I quote, organization of the people. And will you agree with this point of view? And could you precise, so what was, in your mind, the importance of the Charter itself in the Chartist movement? A very close and related question, and it's always in my second point, a very close and related question concerns the place of plots and uprising in the mob, in the movement, above all during its first phase, I mean 1838, 1839, and about the Newport even. Up to your book, I was convinced that the recourse to violence and the recourse to insurrection were a sort of consequence of the political and police repression, and that this recourse was in contradiction with the reformist and legalist principle of the People's Charter. My impression is now much more complex after the reading of your book. We can speak for these people. You know that expression that the French historian Louis Anker coined for about 1841, culture des, he spoke of culture des armes, culture of weapons. But I found that also in your book, culture of weapons, desire of confronting, will of plot, that we traditionally associate with the French or the continental workers' behavior, also appear in your book as main feature of the Welsh and British workers' attitude. And this seems, for instance, completely obvious during the Newport event. But how can we articulate this, what I can tell, taste of plot, taste in plots and in uprising, with the reformist political content of the Charter? And it's also the same idea. Third and last question. It concerns the biographical dimension of your book. I don't want to come back to the choice of narratives as a writing strategy, or to the reasons why you decided to focus on people's life. I mean, I think you fully explained it during the presentation. I personally completely agree with you on this point. But could you tell us more precisely how you chose your Charter's life, which are, of course, in my view, one of the strongest originality of your approach? Were sources and documentation the main criterion, or did the choice take into account other data such as gender, age, local identities, religion, in order to depict a more complete picture of the movement. Did you have or not an intention of a representative set of figure? It's something I didn't finally get in the way you present the, you write the book and you present it. Moreover, don't you think that this choice emphasizes the complexity of the movement? You insist on the last part of the book and on the when you after Kennington, after 1842, you insist on the fragmentation of Chartism at that time, the splitting and bursting of the movement. I don't contend, of course, that this vision is just an effect of your way of writing, of your writing strategy. But of course, it can be argued that such a way of writing could have the same effect on social and political movement that could appear before, more consistent or more homogeneous in more classical way of writing or in more classical surveys. So what will happen, for instance, if we use a similar approach to describe and understand the International Working Man Association in the 60s or in the 70s, June 1936 or May 1968, in other terms, will the gain and benefit in terms of an history from below, that I completely understand and share in a way, will the gain and benefits in terms of knowledge of ordinary people's lives be or not, could or not be cancelled out by a lack of general or overall understanding? In other terms, would you recommend to extend such methodology to more historical issues? And that's for my question.
Okay, I'll try and answer those. I think I'll take them in the order that Dominique,
the one you want,
shared them with us. Yes, I mean, I think at some point in the book, at least in the English version, I borrow my friend and colleague Joan Allen's formulation that Chartism was on the cusp of a transition from a print, from an oral to a print culture. And there is no doubt when one looks at those activities one can define as Chartist, there's a lot more speaking going on at the beginning than there is at the end, and the speech at the beginning is very much to very large audiences, and at the end it's very much to smaller groups in the back rooms of pubs and meeting places. But I think we underestimate the extent to which, across the whole of the 19th century, British political culture was an oral one. Gladstone understood that. You know, in many ways, the most shrewdest political operator in 19th century parliamentary politics or electoral politics, Gladstone understood absolutely perfectly that the power of the spoken word. The Midlothian campaign, which is now enshrined in print, it was a campaign of public speaking in which the reporters of London newspapers had to follow Gladstone across Scotland in order to be able to take back to their readers, by then by telegraph, what the great man was saying. The pulpit, the public meeting, with its intricate, almost dramaturgical structure and procedures, remained much more powerfully and centrally than I think we understand. A major vector, perhaps still the major vector, for the transmission of ideas and opinions. So it's a crucial collision. I don't think I see it as unequal. Maybe in some ways we're rather seduced by the immense success of the Northern Star, with its circulation at one point in 1839 exceeding that of the Times, and therefore by definition it's the largest selling newspaper in world history at that point, we're seduced by the success of the Northern Star to overlook in some ways how frail the print culture was. There are many more Chartist newspapers, but they have very short lives, and Northern Star itself founders in the early 1850s. But the public meeting carries on. I think it would be worth playing with the idea that print is actually at its most potent where it is operating in this grey area with predominantly oral culture. At this year's annual conference of the Social History Society, which is currently in Britain, which is currently my pleasure to chair, our concluding plenary speaker was the Michigan historian of Asia, Murali Muralitharan. And she was arguing that early print forms in Indian nationalism in the decades either side of the First World War have a particular potency and a purchase, precisely because they're operating in a predominantly oral culture where they have to be read out loud. The bulk of the audience cannot read them. And that, of course, is exactly what happens with Northern Star. It's a paper, I urge you to go and look at it online. It's freely available. This is exactly what the Northern Star is like. A lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is actually set in type to enable you, particularly the letters from the leader, Fergus O'Connor, to read it out loud. Lots of italics, block capitals, change of font size, exclamation marks, etc. So it is a crucial collision. I don't think it's a collision that's unequal. I don't think it's one that can be simply translated into the gradual supplanting of oral media of exchange by print-based ones. Much of this print is designed to be read aloud. That would be my argument. The place of the political cult of the People's Charter within Chartism. This takes me back